And hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, March 8th, 2017. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My guests today are Kevin Canty and Noah Lukman. First up is Kevin Canty. He's the author of 6 novels and has been published in The New Yorker, Esquire, GQ, and The New York Times Magazine. He teaches at the University of Montana in Missoula, and he's here today to primarily talk about his new novel, The Underworld. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, how are you?
Great. Great to have you on, too, I must say. I discovered your work, it's been a couple of years, but it was with a story that was in the New Yorker called Mayfly. And then, of course, I immediately had to seek you out and find out what was going on with this writer of the Mayfly. And here you are.
And thrilled to be so.
Will you talk a little bit about The Underworld to begin with and how it came about?
Sure. As I was talking about this last night, I went to a wedding in Butte, Montana, a couple of years ago, and it was very startling. And it set me to thinking about an experience that I'd had earlier in my life. When I moved to Montana, the first summer I spent here, I spent working on the railroad over in Avery, Idaho, which is not far from the town where the actual mine disaster that the book is centered around happened. And so I knew a little bit about that, and I kind of was thinking about that and remembering that, and kind of remembering that way of life, which seems to have largely passed. And so I decided to try to write a novel that was set in another time, which I hadn't done before. And so did some research, sort of like started in with this actual mine disaster in which 91 people were killed in an hour, all the miners, in a very small town, and the sort of reverberations that had around that town, and sort of immersed myself into that world, and then found characters to populate that world. The town and some of the incidents are somewhat real, but the characters are all made up. So.
Interesting. Yeah, I was drawn in right from the start, and so much to talk about in a half hour. You have several point of view characters, and I've read in an interview that I think it was with Caroline Levitt that you don't do much planning and you're definitely not an outliner. So can you talk a little bit about how the various point of view characters came about?
Yeah. It's a funny story. I mean, this started off all from one point of view, from the character David, who's a brother of a miner and son of a miner who's trying to escape that world and has gone to college. And the whole story was told from beginning to end in his viewpoint, which is a novella-sized thing. And I showed it to several early readers, and they liked what they saw but wanted more. And so I layered Anne's story into it, a second point of view character, and it had kind of the same experience. And so the third main point of view character was the last to go in. So the time between the beginning of the novel and the end of the novel, the sequence of events, stays almost exactly the same. But it just sort of grew horizontally by adding more characters and more viewpoints. But I felt like I was able to make the world of the story so much bigger by doing that. And there is something really deeply enjoyable about writing the same sequence of events from the different points of view, just the different personal experiences of the same thing.
So when this idea hit you, were you thinking short story to begin with? It sounds like, I think you said you had enough material for a novella, but it was perhaps more than that, or you wanted it to be more than that?
You know, I wrote it as a novella, thinking, I mean, it was never a short story. It was always too much material for that. But I wrote it as a novella. And, like, I did feel when I was done with that I hadn't exhausted the topic, that there needed to be more to really make it a three-dimensional experience. And so I was glad to dive back into it and do the other work. But I tend to not know. When an idea presents itself, I tend to have to work on it for a while to see how big it's going to be and what kind of shape it's going to have. Because I don't know. I think all my novels have started as short stories, where it's just ideas that I just wrote my way into and tried to figure out what was going on with them.
Well, that's interesting, because I found another story of yours this morning on NewYorker.com, Story with Bird. And I listened to you read that. What a lovely story. And by the appearance of it, it's very simple, but so much is going on in that story. So I'm guessing that came to you as a story, and it was going to remain as a story and not become something big.
Yeah, that one was always something very brief. That is a much simpler story that has relatively few ingredients and really only one character, or one viewpoint character. There's obviously a second character at the beginning who's not there at the end, but. The bird, you know, the bird thing, it's mysterious. That's one of the ones where I had an idea and couldn't figure out how to give it shape, and then that bird showed up, and that was it.
How did the bird show up?
I don't know. it was just kind of, one day it was there, you know. And then once it was there, it, by the sacred rule of threes, it had to come back a couple more times, and you know, and that ended up being what gave the story more of a shape. So then,
are you more of an intuitive writer? If you don't outline or plot, what pulls you through? You know, it's like, I think with literary fiction, often the problem is that there's a lot of great writing and, you know, interesting characters, but nothing much happens. And
right.
And a lot happens in the underworld, and a lot happens actually in your short stories. So what's the through line? What pulls you?
Yeah, I think, you know, my way as a writer is to really find characters that I love in some ways, or really, you know, want to spend time with, and then set them going into trouble of some kind, usually trouble with each other. And so there's a wonderful Bartleme essay called Not Knowing, about the importance of not knowing. So if these characters are in conflict or in trouble, in love or in danger in the middle of the story, and I honestly don't know as the writer how it's going to turn out, then that's where the writing has a chance to really feel alive for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, not knowing the outcome is really important to my process as a writer. It's just like looking at the moment in front of me. This is something I kind of learned from Raymond Chandler. You know, if you're worried about who killed Roger Ackroyd, then he hasn't done his job. You know, it's the scene, it's the moment in front of the reader's eyes that makes all the difference in the world, not the larger sort of scheme of the plot.
So then, can you talk a little bit about your revision process, and let's talk about the underworld. You know, how it began, and what you ended up with. I mean, what do you go through to carve out the story, or refine the story, or get the story right?
This one took quite a while and a lot of help. I had some really good readers on this, including a wonderful editor, Jill Bielowski, and I wrote each of these point of view characters from start to finish, and I wrote them fairly quickly, which meant that I spent really a lot of time just trying to make the stories work together, trying to coordinate them. I spent a month just trying to straighten out the timeline, you know, sitting at my desk with a calendar from 1971 on the wall, and just trying to figure out what happened when and how that worked to get everything in sequence. But this was a weird experience because it was more additive, you know, revising. It was more like putting stuff in there that hadn't been there in the original draft. And then, you know, at the very last stages, of course, there was some cutting and there was some pasting and some, you know, revising stuff and moving stuff around in time and in sequence. So, but this one came together without having to write the 800-page draft that became the 300-page novel.
Is that what you do?
I have done that. I would say the older I get, or the further along I get in my writing career, I would say that I waste less time than I used to. Although I will occasionally write a whole novel that nobody can stand to read. So. But, you know, I think I pull a clock, you know, have a clock running on myself. You know, it's a little bit shorter leash than it used to be. The moment that I start to feel like it's kind of not alive, I will put something away for a while and see if it comes back to life. But I don't waste quite as much time as I used to.
So what you just said, well, what you said a few minutes ago about with the underworld, there was a lot of adding to it. So you started with what seemed to be a novella-sized book, and it needed to be longer, needed to be a novel. And so did you, so sort of take us into your thought processes. Did you go, well, okay, a couple of more point of view characters would do it, show this story from different aspects, or, you know, let's have this character go here, and maybe he's a student, maybe he does this, and maybe he does this. I mean, what sort of things would you go through to flesh it out?
Yeah, it was, with this one, it was kind of entering. David's experience was not mine, but parallel. I was going to college in Missoula at the same time he's going to college in Missoula, and so and I knew people that were like him, and so I sort of, that one was the original take. But David doesn't go in the mine. His brother does, his father does, but he doesn't. And so, you know, I wanted to move back into the town a little bit. So I had him flirting with this with Anne, who's the wife of a miner, at a wedding. And so I thought, well, Anne is really of this town, really a native, really stuck there. So what does the world look like to her? And so I wrote that section. And then a friend said, we never get in the mine. I thought, that's right, we never get in the mine. So I felt like I sort of wanted to enter that, you know, to be physically down in the mine, which meant creating a character who was of that world. So it was kind of entering, you know, to go into the world of the novel.
Well, speaking of Anne, so she's there at the beginning, and something with Anne comes to pass at the end, without giving the ending away. And so you're not a planner, you're not a plotter, and yet you she's there in the beginning. And so I'm reading this thinking, okay, she has to be a part of the ending somehow. Did you know she was going to be a part of the ending?
Yeah, I think I did. I mean, I think that, you know, in the original through line with David, that she was present as a possibility in the end. She became a much stronger player as we went through her point of view. From David's point of view, she was always, you know, a bit of a mystery and a bit of a stranger, although a familiar one. He did grow up in this town, but she, you know, she's sort of a little bit of an other, so it was nice to be able to be inside her head and be in her viewpoint and try to figure out what this experience was like for her.
Jordan, too. She was such a powerful character.
Yeah, she's my favorite character in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Really.
Hmm.
You know, she's the one that's all feeling.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to hear you read from The Underworld. Would you do that?
I would love to.
Okay.
I'll read a brief passage from Before Anything Too Terrible Has Happened about Lyle, the minor character, going to work, and I think it's self-explanatory. Tuesday morning, Lyle has himself a hangover. He really is too old. His work clothes are waiting for him in the dry room, the pants so stiff with grease and dirt that they stand up by themselves. He goes in the toilet, pukes up his breakfast, then he feels a little better. He never even meant to get drunk the night before. It just happened. Just even the smell of this place. He could dump the shift, but him and Terry Willett are working a stope on a contract and almost done with it. Sooner they finish it, the sooner they get paid, and Terry's wife just had another baby. Lyle doesn't mind working with Terry. The thing about Terry is he never talks much, which is fine with Lyle. Nothing worse than a talker. Also, Terry's got a place a little ways out of town, a salt block down by the creek. Lyle has filled his freezer a couple of times with deer he shot off Terry's back porch. Really, Lyle never dumps a shift. It's a game he plays with himself is all. Thinks he could, thinks he might, goes to work anyway. He pulls his steel-toe boots on, grabs his lunch bucket and battery holder and hat and light, heads across the yard to the jewel shaft. It's cold outside, spring morning cold. Lyle lets himself enjoy it, lets it wake him up a little bit. It's the last time he'll be cold today. He rides the chippy down to 3700, where there's the usual mess trying to catch the crummy over to the 10 shaft, 30 miners crowded onto the landing. Lyle misses the first train. While he's waiting, Terry comes down. They nod to each other, ride together facing each other, knees touching. Another crowd in the 10 shaft, but eventually they get lifted down to 5200 where they're working. It's hot down here, always hot. The heat comes off the rock itself, and a damp seeps out of it. What's that smell? Terry says. Lyle stops in place, angles his head up, and sniffs as carefully as a spaniel. But he can only detect the usual stink, diesel, creosote, cordite smell of yesterday's blasting powder. I don't get it, Lyle says. What's it smell like to you? Probably nothing, Terry says, and shrugs his shoulders and walks off deeper into the drift. But it's never nothing, Lyle thinks.
That's great. That was Kevin Canty reading from The Underworld, published by Norton. So Lyle, he was another really interesting character for me and undergoes an incredible change, really.
Yeah, there were guys that I was working with on the railroad that were kind of like him, that were just like really, in some ways, eccentrically straightforward characters, you know. That work meant a lot to them, and when they were done working, they would really, you know, they would head up to Wallace, and they would drink, and they would go to the whorehouses, which were open until the 1980s in Wallace, Idaho. So, and it was just quite a way of life. They would live in the rail cars. They're just disconnected from everything but, you know, work and kind of binging. So, and Lyle is a kind of version of those guys. So, but I didn't want to. He has to have a heart, you know, for me to write about him. And so that was the struggle for me in writing him, was to not write down to him, to let him have a three dimensional world and to have strong feelings that he could express. So that was the challenge of Lyle.
So I'm trying to understand then that without doing a lot of sort of pre-writing or pre-work before you start writing, all of your characters do have arcs. And how much of that do you know? And how much do you need to know before you can move through the book?
Yeah. I mean that's why, you know, my writing is, it tends to be kind of stop start. I'll write as far as I know, and then I'll get stuck, and then I'll put something aside for a while and work on some other stuff. So I'm almost always working on a few things at once. And with this one, obviously, it was the same sort of stop start going through. But you know, you get these characters in motion. David's a fish out of water. He's not. He doesn't really feel like he belongs at the university. He knows he doesn't belong back in his hometown. So that's an unstable position. So you know something is going to happen, you know. And in the beginning, with Anne, she's in a marriage that she is just short of identified as being unhappy, but feels trapped, you know, that in this life. It's a life that she's chosen, and yet she feels trapped by the choices that she's made. So that's an unstable position. So you get, I mean, in physics, it's about having, you know, a missing electron in the outer layer that causes atoms to bond together, that causes, you know, things to happen. And I think all these characters do have that. You know, Lyle's denial of his own kind of heart becomes something that he can't sustain over the course of the novel, and so he has to move toward some opening somewhere. So all these characters have, you know, something that's going to impel them into action, some deep need that's going to get them moving. And once they're moving, then they're moving against each other, and that's kind of where the plot comes from, is because of that interesting, imperfect nature of action. You know, you do something in order to fulfill a desire that you have. But then what the thing that you do creates its own chain of consequences that's often not what you intended. And I think that's what makes both life and novels interesting.
Yeah, that's a great way of describing it. So the plot is really emerging from the characters.
Absolutely. In my writing, the characters come first. But, you know, you're trying to find that time in their lives that is where they're capable of significant action, where something can happen to them. Because, you know, I mean, a lot of my life is super boring, you know. You know, I was married for 30 years, had a couple kids, they were really great, taught at the university, everybody had health insurance, really cool, but not anything you could write about in a million billion years, you know. Like, happy people in the middle of their lives are just super boring. So, I mean, it's something that you wish for yourself and your friends and your loved ones, but it's nothing that you can, you know, you need a little trouble to have something to write about, I think.
Well, one theme running through the work of yours that I've read has to do with choices, and, you know, what if we did this instead of that?
Yeah.
You know, I think in the story I read this morning, it was, you know, what if he'd bought a or got a corgi instead, you know, for his girlfriend.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. In the end, I got stuck with the corgi. I think that there's kind of definitive actions, choices are what stories are built out of that moment. You know, the kind of once in a lifetime, but also revisiting the moment. I mean, I think in that story, that's pretty wishful. You know, that the character knows that nothing much would have changed if he'd done something different. But there's always that, you know, that kind of allure of the possible other path that you could take. So, mm-hmm. You know, and I think in that story, that's pretty much what that is. It's not so much that anything would have happened. he wishes it would have or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in The Underworld, I don't know, a theme. One of the themes for me, and you probably, I'm guessing you don't work from a theme, but one for me was you don't know what you got till it's gone. And
yeah.
Really, just, you know, throughout the book, I'm thinking about my own life and do I show the people I love enough appreciation while they're here and living? And that was really interesting for me to come out of this book.
Yeah, that's there's this, with an event like that, it's such a huge before and after, and there's so much loss and so much grief. But I was reading last night, right at the, from a passage right at the beginning, I mean, just before the beginning of the accident, when David is in botany lab in Missoula and talking about phototropism, which is the way that plants tend to grow toward the light. And it's one of those things, it's an actual, like, you know, Botany 120 experiment. But it was something that I wrote in there that became, in some ways, the image of the book for me is growing out of a really dark place toward the light, growing toward some kind of hope that's not just like applied from outside, but kind of, you know, some kind of grudging hope or some, you know, like the Joan Didion quote is, after a while, the scar tissue starts to form whether you want it to or not.
Mm.
And I think that's, you know, the way that these people move past this genuine tragedy or don't move past. I mean, some of them do, you know, die trying. So, and I think that idea of like moving out of this kind of literal dark place into something that was more hopeful or more, I don't know, just positive, just seemed like the kind of prevailing idea for the book. And I think that was a touchstone as I was going back through and, you know, writing my way through these other passages. I mean, there was a sense in which, you know, not David so much, but Anne and Lyle are a little bit in hell at the beginning of this.
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit not at the end. So so that kind of became, I think that's what I have instead of like themes like this is going to be about this or it's going to be about that. It's just, I have like some like little touchstone gesture or image that I can return to that becomes the sort of through line for me.
I am so sorry we're at the end of our time. We should have had you on for an hour because I have like a dozen more questions at least, so maybe we can have you back on or do something on the blog or get you out here to California to do the speaker series or something.
Anything.
Well, I will write to you, but I'd love The Underworld, and I'm so glad you wrote it. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. That was Kevin Canty. His new book is The Underworld, published by Norton. And I did love this book very much, and I do wish I could talk to him more. So we'll have to do that. Anyway, stay with us. When we come back, we'll have Noah Lukman with us. Don't go anywhere.
They say time heals a broken heart. Days go by and the healing starts. They say life goes on. Well, I can't prove it, but I know they're wrong. microphone me. I had love, but it turned out wrong. I had faith, and when that was gone, well, at least I had hope. But you left me hanging at the end of my rope. I can't sleep, I can't eat, I don't seem to be able to get back on my feet. I can't run, I can't hide, and it's tearing me up inside. On me, have mercy, mercy, baby. Love's been rough on me.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. And if you want to keep apprised of the shows that are podcast each week, if you go to iTunes to Writers on Writing, you might have to find it under Pen on Fire or under my name. I don't know. It comes up different ways, but you could subscribe, and when we post a new show, you will be notified. You'll be able to listen to that show. So this one will go up in the next week or so, and if you are so kind as to leave us a review, that will get the show up there more visible in the rankings for other listeners to find. We are back, and I'm so happy to bring Noah Lukman on. Noah Lukman is a literary agent in New York. He is the author of the best-selling The First Five Pages, A Dash of Style, and The Plot Thickens. He was on some years ago, I think when The First Five Pages came out, and I loved it then, and I love it even more now. And let's bring him on. Hey, Noah.
Hey, Barbara, thank you for the kind words. It's great to be back on. I think it's been 10 years now.
Yeah. Wow, 10 years. Well, you know, I remember having you on, and I recently rediscovered The First Five Pages and have begun recommending it to my students and everyone who is writing or trying to write to read it. And I find it still...
Oh, that's very kind of you.
It's still so incredibly relevant. I don't know if you can remember what your inclination was to write this book, but will you talk a little bit about how it might have come about?
Yeah, sure, of course. I mean, you know, when you work as a literary agent, you get thousands of submissions each year from writers who would like you to represent them. And maybe on average, you get about 10,000 submissions a year. Some of these are query letters or proposals or partials or entire manuscripts. And you know, if you want to survive in the publishing industry as an agent or as an editor, you have to learn how to read a lot of writing very quickly and make very quick decisions, which kind of goes against everything that we are taught to do. Usually you want to take your time and read slowly and carefully, but there's no way you can actually survive in the business side of it if you have to decide on 100 manuscripts or submissions in a single day. So those who survive in the industry learn how to judge a piece of writing very quickly and hopefully to make the right decisions. The point of this book is how to look at a piece of writing and make a decision within a few pages on the merit of the writing for the entire book. And quite frankly, usually a publishing professional makes a decision based upon the first page or the first few sentences even. So decisions happen very quickly.
So what do you parse from the first couple of paragraphs or the first page? I mean, how, you know, a lot of writers say, well, you know, the story gets going as you get into the book and, you know, I need to, you know, just sort of set the stage, right?
Right. Well, you know, one of the big points of this book is that, you know, before you look at the big picture as a writer in terms of plot, pacing, characterization, dialogue, you have to start and look at the technical aspects of writing. So what I liken it to is somebody sitting down to listen to and evaluate someone's skill at playing the piano. So you, if someone does not, if someone cannot play the piano well, you don't need to listen to them for an hour, right? So if they're hitting the wrong notes or the wrong keys or the rhythm is off, you can tell usually within about 5 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And the metaphor holds true for writing. If technically they're doing things that are just not professional, you can see that right away. And 99% of submissions are ruled out right away because they're not doing things that are professional. And so the point is to really strengthen your fundamentals and your writing skills and make sure everything is professional and up to par. And that is just, being professional is just a starting point. And then you're up against all the other professional writers. And then you start looking at big picture things like pacing and plot and characterization and arc and, you know, resolution and all these issues. But honestly, 99% of submissions will never even get to that point. So the point of this is to take a step back and really, to really, you know, shore up on your fundamentals as writing. A lot of people, you know, they'll say, listen, I've never written a book in my life. I've never done any writing. But I consider myself a great writer because I learned how to read and write. You know, I've been writing school papers and reports and, you know, business memos my entire life. So I assume that I'm a great writer. And I just had a great idea for a great plot. And I'm just going to write it. And even though I've never written a short story or novel or fiction before or spent time studying the craft of writing, I'm just going to write this and send it off to you. And they assume that because the plot is so good, at least in their mind, that the fact that they're not skilled writers doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
But the point of this book is it does matter. It's all about the fine detail. It's all about the execution. You can have a brilliant plot which is poorly executed and falls apart on the page. It doesn't matter how great your concept is. It's really irrelevant. Whereas you can have a sort of quiet, mediocre plot that's, you know, beautifully written and brilliantly executed, and the book could become a bestseller. So the point is, a lot of people approach writing saying, well, the concept is so strong, I don't need to pay attention to anything else. And the point of this book is, no, that's not true. You do need to pay attention to this. You do need to become a very strong writer, and then you can focus on other things.
Hmm. Your second chapter is on adjectives and adverbs. In the first line of the chapter, you say, after its presentation, the quickest and easiest way to reject a manuscript is to look for the overuse or misuse of adjectives and adverbs.
Yeah, you know, if you're an agent or an editor and you want to, you know, read and evaluate a piece of writing very quickly, usually you can scan a page and usually make a decision within, honestly, a few seconds. If it's very heavy on adjectives and adverbs, almost always that's the sign that the writing's not strong enough because, you know, you have to choose stronger nouns and stronger verbs. You can't pile on the adjectives and adverbs and have it do the work for you. First of all, you know, inevitably these end up being separated by commas, which slows down the pace, and you shouldn't have to, you know, pile on adjectives in order to make the noun stronger. What you really need is a stronger noun or the stronger verb. So, you know, this comes down to, again, one of the fundamentals of writing, which is word choice. A lot of times if you're piling on adjectives and adverbs, it's an indicator that your choice of word wasn't strong enough. A good writer will spend a lot of time dwelling. Some writers will spend an entire day dwelling on whether this is exactly the right word they've chosen. These are very careful, meticulous professionals. Other writers will just plow through and write, you know, 50 pages a day because they're racing for a plot and they won't stop to think about their word choice. This also ties into word economy and economy of words. You know, almost always if I receive a query letter that's very long versus one that's very short, inevitably the one that's very short will be end up being the more impressive of the two because, you know, as Mark Twain said, it's much harder to write it's much harder to write a short letter than a long one. Mm-hmm. You know, what his saying was something like, I didn't have time to write you a short letter, so I wrote you a long one, something like that. You know, and it certainly holds true. It takes a lot of time and effort to, you know, it's quick and easy to write, let's say, a one-page piece of writing, but it takes a lot of time and effort to look at that one page and say, okay, how do I get this down to half a page? You know, where can I really, you know, use word economy here? What word can I put? How can I say this in a shorter, tighter way? That's really hard to do, but, you know, every word that you say is one word less that the reader has to read to get where they're going. So you don't want to give a reader a 600-page book when you could have accomplished the same thing in 200 pages. So it seems like it's not a big deal when you're talking about a single page or paragraph, but over the course of several hundred pages, that really adds up, and that can end up making the difference between a 300- or 600-page book. So, again, this goes back to the point of that it's about the journey, word by word, line by line, paragraph by paragraph. And really that kind of separates the amateur from the professional writer. The amateur just plows ahead, not thinking of the journey, wanting to execute the bigger picture issues. The professional will really hone in on the actual every single word and line and paragraph, and they'll agonize over whether they've made the right decision. Sort of like a painter who just takes a big brush and does huge strokes and finishes a painting in 10 minutes versus somebody who takes, you know, very fine brushes and fine strokes and works on a painting for years. It's the same thing. I mean, you can accomplish and finish a painting in an hour or in 30 years. So it's the same canvas, but very different execution.
Mm. Oh, along those lines, though, what about the minimalist writer who works on a novel and the novel is 200 pages when maybe it needs to be 300? How do they deal with, you know, word choice, and maybe they already have, and that's why it's so minimal?
Well, that's a very interesting question that you bring up, and, you know, that's an extremely rare case. You almost never, ever see a book that's too short and needs to be longer. Mm-hmm. And when it does, I would say it's much better to err on the side of word economy mm-hmm. than saying too much, because in that case, first of all, you admire the person's economy and that he's worked so hard to get it so tight. And in that case, you can certainly, you know, offer suggestions of, you know, beef this up or beef that up, you know, add a scene here, develop this character more, et cetera, et cetera. But the bones and the foundation are there. But it's the interesting thing is you almost never, ever see that. Almost always the converse is true.
Interesting.
Where a book is it needs to be cut in certain areas. Hmm. But, you know, this goes back to the whole point of, you know, really how much thought and care somebody puts into something, whether they do it in a quick kind of hasty way or really gives it a lot of thought and care. Because the point of this isn't even so much about the first five pages. It's about, if you see that a writer approaches the first five pages with such incredible care, then that is, you know, indicative of a certain mentality. It's a very conscientious, meticulous mentality. Everything's been cared about and thought through to the nth degree. And then you can assume if they apply this sort of conscientiousness to every single word in line, then thus it goes to follow. They've also applied the same sort of really vigorous conscientiousness to the entire book, to the plot, to the characters, to the progression, to the arc, to the resolution, to the settings, to everything. So that's really what you're looking for. You're looking for this sort of very conscientious mentality. And if they've been sloppy with the execution of the first few pages, it goes to follow they probably were sloppy with their plot and settings and everything else. So this is really more about the mentality that you're looking for than it is the actual first few pages.
If you just tuned in, you tuned in a little bit late, but we have time left with Noah Lukman. His books are The First Five Pages, The Plot Thickens, and A Dash of Style. I love your chapter on sound, and you rarely see anyone write about this in writing books. And to me, it's so incredibly important. Will you talk a little bit about sound?
Absolutely. You know, I often say that poets make the best novelists and the best writers in general because they have harbored this mentality of, you know, laboring for days or weeks or months or years over a single word or line or page. And that's the mentality that novelists need to bring to their writing. And poets also very much are obsessed with the sound of prose. And, you know, sentences rise and fall and they have rhythm. And there's a very important rhythm to, you know, not only to sentences, but to paragraphs and that follows to chapters, you know, every, and of course to books. A book has a natural arc, a rise and fall and a resolution, but so does each chapter, and so does each section break, and so does each paragraph, and so does each sentence. So writers who really harness and understand the sound of language and the rhythm of language can really add a whole other dimension where the words read almost like poetry, and it just resonates properly. You know, writers who don't pay attention to that can kind of just try to get words across the page for the sake of it, and it can come off as being a little bit clunky. You know, one of the exercises I recommend is to take your piece of writing and to read it out loud, which is something that most novelists never take the time to do. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it will surprise you. You take your first page or chapter you've written, you read it out loud, and you're like, oh, my God, this is actually very repetitive and redundant. That didn't really sound good, and this is going on way longer than I had imagined it in my head. And it teaches you a lot to hear it out loud. Hmm.
You talk about showing versus telling and how writers are confused about this. On 124, I think it is, you say, stating facts is not the same as telling. Telling directs us to the conclusion we should come to about facts. Facts are just facts. Will you embellish?
Yeah, I mean, showing versus telling is an age-old issue when it comes to writing. It's one of the first things that most writing professors will address, which is that you never want to stop a book and tell a reader what's happening. Because when you stop and tell, let's say you just stop and you want to fill in on the character's backstory, for example. You stop the action, you stop the pacing and the progression, and you devote a page or two to telling us everything about this character's past. First of all, it's dry and it reads like a synopsis. So you're kind of leaving the world of fiction and entering the world of factual nonfiction. You're stopping the pacing and the progression, and readers don't want to just be told about things. Readers want to be shown things. So instead of stopping with a particular character and telling us about her backstory, you might want to show it in little bits and pieces and sprinkle it out through the entire chapter or book so that it doesn't, number one, affect the pacing or progression, and number two, it can come out in more interesting, more subtle ways without feeling like there's a stark contrast in this book. There's this yin-yang of now I'm showing what's happening, now I'm going to stop and put a break and tell you things, and now I'm going to show you. A lot of times writers will use dialogue as a means to an end to convey information or tell us things, and it really stands out like a sore thumb when you're dealing with telling and dialogue. John is talking to Mary, and John, you know, in his natural dialogue to her, starts, you know, telling her what's happening in the plot or things like that. You know, that's very obvious. You know, when two people are talking to each other, you have to ask yourself, how would these two people really talk to each other? Usually people know each other. Usually people talk, they're more economical in what they have to say. They might use insider language or reference things that only they know. They wouldn't, like, stop and talk in an awkward, formal way and use that to fill readers in on what's happening in the book.
Hmm. Well, speaking of reading aloud, you know, I find that, too, that it's so useful to read my stuff aloud. And when I suggest this to writers, I get a lot of resistance somehow. I mean, people agree, yeah, that's a good idea, but no one really wants to do it.
Yeah, you know what? We're living in a different age where everybody wants instant gratification, and there's a lot of things people don't want to do. They want to, you know, get the book written and done and get it sold and published and have it in their hands and kind of skip all of this hard work. The point of this book is that you should become a master craftsman in what you do and not look for instant gratification. Whether it takes, you know, months or years. The point of this book is to kind of encourage and inspire you to be better at what you're doing line by line and word by word. And also to encourage and inspire you of not to give up. I mentioned how Stephen King, his first four novels were rejected. John Grisham, his first novel was rejected. And these writers, you know, they persevered book after book, year after year, rejection after rejection, everyone telling them that their books would never sell or they didn't like their books. So, it's a brutal industry, the book publishing industry, and you don't want to enter an unsure footing, being unsure about yourself, having written a novel hastily. you want to make sure that you are a master craftsman and that your novel is brilliant. You know it is, so that if everybody rejects it, you won't second-guess yourself. You can rest easy.
Do you think self-publishing has encouraged the sort of laziness when it comes to craft and really working the material?
You know, that's an interesting question. Self-publishing is really a double... It's a double-edged sword. It's a blessing and a curse in that way. I mean, a curse in as much as, yes, of course, it can encourage sloppiness and laziness to kind of just get your book out, get it done, not having any kind of a sounding board, you know, and just kind of putting it out there. You know, but at the same time, self-publishing brings a lot of benefit. A lot of authors who are getting their works published, you know, electronically and to a lot of success that would not have had it otherwise. And I think that's great. It also gives them a chance to, you know, kind of have a public sounding board and explore what's working and bounce their work off of other writers. I mean, I think ultimately self-publishing in the whole ebook world does a lot more good than bad in that regard because, you know, listen, as a literary agent, people think that, you know, agents just sit there rejecting writers all day long. But the fact is that agents themselves are rejected all day long because if I take on a novel I love and I submit it to 30 publishers, usually it will take 30 or 40 or 50 rejections until even I can sell it. And there have been brilliant books that I've shopped around everywhere for years and I still couldn't sell it. So as an agent, I'm the one getting rejected all day long from all the editors of the publishing houses. And you just have to, you know, block it out and not listen to that and persevere. Because 29 will reject it, the 30th will buy it. A year later, the book will become a bestseller. And if you had listened to 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 or 25 of these editors, you wouldn't have persevered. So I understand how few gatekeepers are in this industry. And even if it's a great book from a great author coming from a respected agent, even then the chances are slim that you can sell it. So if self-publishing comes along and gives all these authors a venue to get their books published, I think that's a wonderful thing because it could be that many of these authors and their books are actually quite worthy, but they're just caught up in the whole, you know, very narrow gatekeeping world of book publishing and that they never had a chance to have their books published when they should be. So it does bring about sloppiness, but it also brings about success. And I think that if they publish their book and it's self-published and it's sloppy and the feedback lets them know that, I think that's good too because then they can see it with their own eyes and then hopefully revise their work and focus harder on their craft. Whereas if they shopped it around and nobody published it or bought it, they could always just rail against the publishing industry and say the problem's not my writing, it's the industry. So, I think ultimately it's a good thing.
Yeah, that's a great answer. That's really great because I don't think writers think of agents being rejected and how many times they may have to send something out to get a yes.
Yeah, I mean, as an agent, your life is one of constant rejection. I mean, when you're actively submitting something, you're just getting rejections all day long and editors telling you all the reasons why the book isn't good and why it won't sell. And you have to be strong and continue on. You know, it's funny, a lot of times you'll sell a book after all these rejections, it'll come out and become a bestseller, and then the 30 editors who rejected it will say, why didn't you send that to me? And
I did
send it to you, you know.
Well, I know a lot of writers who, you know, after a few rejections from an agent, they'll stop sending their stuff out because they, oh, you know, I got 5 rejections, then, you know, must not be working.
Well, you know, one of the biggest things that I can't emphasize enough is that I've been to writer conferences all around the country for many years, and I've heard the same exact thing that you're telling me. You know, writers saying I sent it to 2 agents or 5 agents, and they didn't want it, so I gave up. And that, you know, that's a heartbreaking thing to hear. You never want to hear that. You know, I always encourage them. I say, first of all, getting published is really a numbers game. You cannot give up after 5 agents or 10 or 15 or 20. I always say the first thing you should do is aim to send it to at least 50 agents, maybe even 100. The second thing is that you have to really research your agents very well. Use sites like Publishers Marketplace or Publishers Weekly or Google and really know who you're targeting. Because a lot of times these 5 agents they send it to were not even the appropriate agents to begin with. So first of all, you do your research. You find agents who worked and sold on books that are similar to yours. You find agents who are legitimate. Make sure they have a good track record selling to reputable publishers. Make sure their deals are recent. You don't want someone who's only done deals 10 years ago. Make sure they've done a lot of deals. So if you find an agent that's done a lot of deals recently to major houses and the books are similar to yours, you know, that's a good starting point. And then you want to get 50 or maybe even 100 of these agents. And then when you submit to them, you don't want to submit to one and wait 3 months to hear back, because then it'll take you 10 years to work your way through it. You want to submit to, let's say, 10 at a time, wait a couple of weeks, do 10 more. So the point is within 3 or 6 months, you've gone through all 50 or 100 agents. As opposed to choosing 5 agents who are the wrong agents, submitting to one a year, and 5 years later, you've gotten nowhere. So you really have to approach it properly.
Is it all right or encouraged to or advised to attach or include the first couple of pages with a query?
Every agent has their own requirements. I personally recommend that you mail a one-page query letter because I always think the shorter the better. I'm always more impressed by economy of words. Just, you know, a couple of lines, what your story is about, a few lines about you, you know, impress somebody with your economy of words. And then let them request more if they choose to. You know, if they're excited by your letter, they'll ask for more. If they're not excited, I seriously doubt a few pages will excite them. Of course, the query letter is an off form in and of itself, and the letter has to be good, because sometimes you have a great writer with a bad letter, and vice versa. You know, I've written a bunch of free ebooks that I give away for free online. How to write a great query letter. How to find and keep a literary agent. And a collection of 2 years of my blog, Ask a Literary Agent. There's several hundred pages of information, and it's all up there for free for anybody who wants it.
NoahLukeman.com?
Yeah, you can find it there. You can find it on Amazon or any of the e-tailers. It's just, you just go online. It's an e-book. It's a free download. So that's a great place to start, because there's several hundred pages of addressing all of these things we've discussed, but much more in depth. And one of the other things I say to them is that, you know, while you're querying agents, never, ever stop writing. One of the most powerful things you can do as a writer is not just have one book, but have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 books. So, because a lot of times it could be, like Stephen King, his first 4 books didn't sell. So you don't want to write a book, then put your career on hold, you know, query agents, wait a year to hear back, and then say, well, if the industry accepts me, I'll write another one. If it doesn't, I'll quit. You want to keep writing and writing, because, number one, you get better and better with each book you write. Number two, you don't want to wait for validation from the industry. You want to keep working on your craft and having more and more books, and not really pay attention to what the industry says. And then it could be 5 years from now you have a catalog of 5 books that you've written that have never sold, and then you sell one, and then they want all 6 of them or all 5 of them. So
that's great advice.
Yeah, never stop writing. It's like working out. The muscle fades. You want to keep it going.
I think you're the king of metaphor.
They're
throughout your books. I love your writing, and your books are just great to read. And I really appreciate you coming back on the show. Thank you.
Oh, I'm happy to come on. I mean, anytime you ask me to, I'm here. Don't worry.
Thank you, Noah.
All right. Well, it was great talking to you, and I'm wishing you the best.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Well.
That was Noah Lukeman. He is the author of The First 5 Pages, The Plot Thickens, and A Dash of Style. Very generous guy. And you can find free ebooks, as he said, on his website, noahlukeman.com, or go to Amazon. And I believe they are free there for Kindle. So that's all we have today. We'll be back next week. And until then, stay in the chair, keep the pen moving, keep the fingers moving, and keep up the hope and keep writing. Bye-bye.